talk1370.com.
Previously,
I heard from a friend that smoking pot lowers sperm count.
Yes, that is true. Marijuana smoking can impact sperm count, sometimes even the motility. So yes.
What I was told is that it debilitates normal functioning sperm and like the way we're malfunctioning.
No.
No? Okay, you see, I don't know. You're a doctor.
No, I would not recommend.
This is Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn with the Texas Fertility Center on this beautiful afternoon, the day before Halloween, with Dr. Kaylin Silverberg, my partner, and our guest is Dr. Wendy Cutler. But we are txfertility.com, our website. Don't hesitate to ever go there because there's a lot of good information that you can look at if you have any questions in regard to fertility. Also, if you have any questions, we're live at 390-1370. Talk1370.com. Kaylin, good afternoon.
Thomas, how are you?
I'm just fine. And we're so happy to have a guest with us today.
I know it. And especially, she's a good friend of ours. She's a good friend of our practice, Dr. Wendy Cutler, and we'll introduce her in just a second. I just want to first tell everybody that that Dr. Cutler is part of the Austin Diagnostic Clinic. She is one of the leaders in their OBGYN department there. And they have been so gracious to us. They've been tremendous friends of Texas Fertility for almost 15 years now. We've been having an office out there, and we see patients out there on Wednesday mornings, and their staff is just crackerjack. They are so nice, and they're so good, and we work so closely with them. So, Wendy, we're so happy we could finally twist your arm and get you to join us to come on the radio today. And I know you're a little nervous, but this is going to be fun.
Well, thank you, Kaylin. Thank you for having me. Let me just introduce myself. I went to medical school of University of Colorado School of Medicine, graduated there of class of 1999, and then did my residency training in UT San Antonio. And soon after that, I came to Austin, joined Austin Diagnostic Clinic. Since then, I've been here for almost 7.5 years, and I enjoyed Austin. I enjoyed to work with Texas Fertility Center and Dr. Vaughn and Dr. Silverberg and all their colleagues. And whenever I have a question, I can just pick up a phone, and they're just a phone call away. They have helped us tremendously. So thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
We're really glad to have you. And we know a lot about Wendy because I think Kaylin was on the faculty at UT San Antonio when Wendy was doing her training. So we've known good things about her even before she came to Austin.
But she broke rule number one, and that is you never give dates. I mean, she said, you know, when she graduated, and now, you know, there are people out there with a calculator trying to figure out, okay, how old is this woman? How old can she
right,
be? She sounds
right.
like she's a little kid.
Because she looks so young, she doesn't mind everyone figuring out her age, right?
Well, thank you, guys. Thank you.
Well, listen, we talked about several different topics, and mm-hmm. I asked you, you know, what do you want to talk about today? And you came up with lots of different interesting topics. And so why don't we just launch right into one of them? Let's talk about ovulation prediction kits and
yeah.
what happens?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I have a well-established practice, and lots of patients actually come in. Every day I will have to talk about preconception counseling, things that they worried about or they have tried for several months, and now they come in, they're nervous. They worried about it. They feel the pressure. And they said, okay, Dr. Cutler, I got this over-the-counter ovulation kit. Or what do I do? And how is it reliable? Or how do I do it? So I'd like to hear that from you guys.
Well, Thomas, you want to lead off with this
yeah,
one?
Yeah. You know, I think these kits are very, very helpful. In the old days, all couples had was a basal body temperature. And what that would tell you is maybe you did ovulate, but 3 or 4 days before, and then it was too late to plan intercourse. So these predictor kits detect a hormone called LH, or luteinizing hormone, and when they're positive, women tend to ovulate about 12 to 18 hours after it's detected in the urine. And so this allows a couple to know in advance that they're going to ovulate and to plan sexual intercourse. This has just been really, really helpful. If a couple were sexually active 3 or 4 times a week on their own, they probably don't need to know exactly what day they're ovulating. But if couples are only sexually active once or twice a week, then this has really been helpful.
Well, Just to clarify that a little bit, I mean, you know, it's you know, being sexually active 3 to 4 times in a week is one thing. You just don't want it to happen in one day.
Right.
Right? So, I mean, we got to make sure that it all gets spread out. So what we advise our couples, obviously, is sex every other day.
Okay,
as opposed to every day. And that's really true for guys with high sperm counts, low sperm counts, and pretty much everything in between. I mean, we'll have patients who, you know, the spouse will say, oh, my God, my husband's got 100 million sperm per mil. Can't we have sex twice a day? And, you know, the answer is, well, sure, you can. But even if a guy, you know, has a great sperm count, if he ejaculates 3 times within a 24-hour period, that's it. The sperm count's depleted. So he'll turn himself from a guy who's got a great sperm count into a guy who essentially has a horrible sperm count.
Well, actually, I have patients actually point out that they read the instructions on these packages. And some of the package even said you have 24 hours. So I think that's too late to have sex.
Yeah.
And I told them is once you see the change right away, you got to make the arrangement.
You know, a good recommendation to a couple is if they are more likely to have intercourse at nighttime, at bedtime, that to test in the morning. And then if they're positive that morning, then 12 or so hours later is really perfect timing. It is always better to get sperm before ovulation than after ovulation.
Right.
So this works really well. We actually tell patients if they prefer intercourse in the morning, maybe to test at dinner the night before so that they can feel real comfortable that their timing is perfect.
Absolutely. You know, that's good.
The other issue is that sometimes ovulation prediction kits, which are meant to kind of reduce stress because it lets you know more clearly when ovulation is going to happen, sometimes it works the opposite way and it increases stress. So, you know, the couple, they're trying to make their plans, they're, you know, having their day, they're, you know, both at work and they come home and, you know, the first question is, okay, do you have a surge? Did you not have a surge? Do we have to have sex? Do we not have to have sex? So I use it a little bit differently. And what I tell my couples is, you know what, start with the beginning of the cycle, end of the cycle, you want to have sex once a day, twice a day, not at all, doesn't matter. But mid-cycle, I really want you to come up with a strategy. And what I would like for that strategy to be is for you to plan on having intercourse every other day. So take your typical cycle length. If your cycle's 28 days, okay, subtract 17 from that. So now you've got 28 minus 17 is 11. Mm-hmm. And on day 11, start having sex every other day and have sex until 3 days after your LH surge, okay? Because that way they can plan for it and they use the kit differently. Instead of using the kit to say, oh, my God, we've got to go home and have sex right now or in tomorrow morning or tomorrow night, they can say, you know what? We know when we had a surge, it's reassuring. We know that we're ovulating this month, and we know that we can keep having sex every other day until 3 days after that surge, and then we can do what we want.
I think that sounds like a good plan. Another question I get is, which brand do I get? And the price range is wide. Some are computerized, are very sophisticated. Some are simple. Right. So can you shine some lights on that?
Yeah, well, some of these kits are, you know, they can be hundreds of dollars if you use these monitors. And you know, then on the other hand, you need to have a microscope sometime to distinguish between the colors because the kits were initially what are called colorimetric.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would, a woman would check one day and she wouldn't have a surge. So the stick would be white. And for those people out there who are listening and they're thinking, what are they talking about? What happens is to use an ovulation prediction kit, the woman wakes up in the morning, typically empties her bladder. And then the second urination, she collects a little bit of a specimen in a cup. And then takes a stick out of this kit and dips the stick into the cup, into the urine. And then she watches for 30 seconds or a minute and a half or 3 minutes, depending upon what kit you use. And typically, if there's LH in the urine, it will interact with chemicals on that stick and cause the stick to turn color. And so there is a guide called a surge guide that comes with these kits. And it's got a specific color and a specific shade of that color. Usually they're blue. Sometimes they're pink. It's kind of funny how they get those colors. But anyway, typically they're blue. And you look at the surge guide, and it's got a certain shade of blue. And so when you check your stick, you hold that stick up after a minute and a half or so to the surge guide. And the question that you're asked is that stick, is the color on that stick as dark or darker than the surge guide?
I think that's hard to do sometimes.
It's really hard to do.
Don't you love it? Sometimes I'll have a patient say, it's supposed to be blue. How blue is blue? And then they'll call her husband. Come in here. Is this blue? You took too long. It's faded by now. Why don't you get in here fast?
Right. Exactly right. So
absolutely,
there are other kits now. There's one that we like, and we're not here to plug any of the brands, mm-hmm, but there's one that we do like called Clear Blue Easy Read. And the difference between that kit and the blue kits is that you'll get a smiley face. And, you know, kind of funny how they decided on a smiley face, but that's good. And so, you know, there's a smiley face there or there's not a smiley face there. It's a lot easier for people to interpret.
always better to have just a yes or a no with those kits. And these do not need to be with the monitor. We don't need to spend the money on that. But the kits have been helpful. And of course, all of this is very stressful. The couples don't want to just be told to have intercourse by a kit, but of course they do need to at least one day that month.
Dr. Vaughn, may I interrupt? Earlier you mentioned basal body temperature. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When I was trained, you know, by then years ago, we were told, you know, do those things and plug it on the paper and then bring in and we'll interpret them for you. And then later on, you know, recently I've been talking to Dr. Silverberg, and I think the newer recommendation is not to do that. It's
correct.
Not reliable.
It's data that you get later and you've determined maybe you have already ovulated, and that's not as helpful. The other thing is, not all temperature charts are easily interpreted. Sometimes the rise is kind of slow. Sometimes they don't see it as well. We've just felt that is more stressful, and you're doing that every day. So we really... did Dr. Silverberg train you that way in San Antonio?
I can't remember.
No, sir. I told her the same thing that I tell other people. I tell my patients, you know what, take that thermometer, put it in the medicine cabinet,
that's
and use
right.
it when you're sick, because that's what it's for. But
to
get back to basal body temperature charts, the reason that they've been discredited really is because of a big study that came out of the University of Southern California. And it's a pretty cool thing. They have a sleep center. And so they would bring women in who were infertility patients. They'd put them in the sleep center, and they would spend 5 or 6 days in this sleep center. And they would draw their blood 2 or 3 times a day. They would do vaginal ultrasounds 2 or 3 times a day. And they would have them track their temperature. And what they found was, because they did ultrasound, they knew exactly when those patients ovulated, within a couple hour range.
Mm-hmm.
And they would then correlate that with blood LH levels, urine LH levels, and basal body temperature charting. And that's how it was determined that blood LH levels are really predictive, urine LH levels are really predictive. But the basal body temperature, there was a 5-day range during which patients could have ovulated following that LH surge or following that that rise in temperature. And so it's really not very good. And we encourage our couples now really to not even waste their time with it. It's stressful. You have to wake up every morning. You know, you pop the thermometer under your tongue and check your temperature before you do anything. And there's really no good reason to do that.
That's great. Great advice.
Well, I'll tell you what, I think we're going to come up against our first break here. So just to remind everybody, this is Beyond the Birds and Bees with the Texas Fertility Center. Our website, www.txfertility.com. Our office number is area code 512-451-0149. And also, we'd love to take your calls today. So if you have any questions, please call us in at 390-1370, and we'll see you on the other side of the break.
Talk 1370, the right choice for weekends.
He did the Monster Mash.
The Monster Mash.
Welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Hi, I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn again with Dr. Kalen Silverberg. We're partners at Texas Fertility Center. And today we have a guest, Dr. Wendy Cutler, who's an obstetrician gynecologist with the Austin Diagnostic Clinic. Wendy's not in solo practice. She has partners. Tell us a little bit about the clinic and your partners.
All right. Well, I'm with Austin Diagnostic Clinic. We are a physician-owned multi-specialty group. We have more than 120 physicians in our group now. So under the OBGYN department, we have Dr. Barber, Dr. Schieffer, Dr. Meyer, Dr. Devine, and Dr. McNellis, and myself. And we do have a very busy practice, and we still love to have new patients. And we deliver at the brand new Women's Center of the Texas at North Austin Medical Center.
And North Austin Medical Center's at North Mopac and Palmer.
Mopac and Palmer, absolutely.
You can't miss it. It's a gorgeous hospital.
It is a beautiful labor and delivery.
St. David's healthcare system.
Yes, sir, it is.
Well, we're glad to have you with us. And in the last segment, we were talking a little bit about ovulation predictor kits and how to use them to time intercourse to ensure that the couple doesn't miss their ovulation time. Anything we want to add to that from the first segment on ovulation predictor kits?
No,
I think we covered it pretty well.
Yeah, me too.
Too.
I think we basically focused down on one that's real user-friendly, that's a happy face, and not to spend a lot of money on the monitor, computer but just to buy the little sticks and test the urine.
I think that, you know, couples can spend a fortune on ovulation prediction kits month after month after month. And so, you know, we like to tell our patients, you know what, start off with a relatively inexpensive kit that works for you. And once you find one that's reliable, that you can interpret, that you're comfortable with, stick with it.
Yeah, that's the key. If it works for you, that's all that matters, whatever it is, whether it's a pink change, color change, or blue color change, whatever it may be.
Now, I do want to talk about one other thing, and that is, what do you do when the kit doesn't work? I mean, you know, what does that mean? I mean, and the answer is, it can mean a couple of different things. It can mean, A, it was a bad kit. B, it could mean that you maybe didn't ovulate that month. But what you need to do is, you need to certainly talk to your physician. So, you know, they need to come in and see you guys or see us or something and say, hey, listen, I think I'm having regular cycles, but I just don't know because I'm not having a surge with this kit. So what do you look for when a couple comes in and the woman says, you know what, I'm not really sure if I'm ovulating or not. I mean, are there any particular things you're looking for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I usually would check a cycle day 21 progesterone level. For people who don't know what cycle day is, cycle day, we start counting cycle day 1 is the first day of the period. So cycle day 21, we go ahead and order a blood work, check the progesterone level. And, you know, if it's normal or higher, then it indicate that woman has ovulated about a week ago. So I think that's a pretty standard thing to do.
And I think there are two real important things there. One is, we define the cycle beginning as the first day of flow, just what you were saying, Wendy, the first day of flow. If there's a little spotting a day or two before, we consider that premenstrual spotting, and the flow is day one. The other thing is that progesterone level is very helpful, particularly if a woman says, I didn't get an LH surge this month. And so then if you check the progesterone level over the next week and it's high, that would suggest she did ovulate, so the kit just didn't pick it up. If it's low, then she didn't ovulate. Despite the fact that she has regular cycles, she may not be ovulating. So I think that is very helpful, particularly whenever a woman says, I'm not detecting an LH surge, but she thinks she's ovulating.
Right.
In fact, we're just getting a question that's coming in from a caller, and the question is, when do you have a patient, if you've got a patient who has irregular cycles, when does she start testing her kit? I mean, what should she do? How does she know when to test? How does she know when to stop testing? When should she say, you know what, enough's enough? Because otherwise, you know, you may be buying kit after kit after kit for 1 month.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do have, you know, these patients coming in with irregular cycle. They'll bring their calendar, and, you know, their periods can be anywhere between 21 days to 40-some days.
Right.
I think that is very challenging. And at times I may, we can calculate the most likely period of time they may be ovulating and do a few months like that. I would not recommend month after month to have these tests done.
Sure.
And, you know, at times I have to look into other causes of why, you know, she's having long periods.
Right. I mean, we tell our patients that if your cycle's more than 35 days or so, you're not ovulating. And even if you do have an LH surge on day 20 or day 30, that's probably not going to be good because there's really two cycles that are going on. There's the ovarian cycle, where you're making eggs and the follicle is growing and eventually ovulation happens. But then once that egg comes out and it meets up with the sperm and you get an embryo, that embryo has to attach to the uterine wall. And so there's the uterine cycle also. And so if you're ovulating on day 30, it's great. Nice to know that you're ovulating on day 30, but you're probably not going to get pregnant because when that embryo gets to the uterus, that uterine lining is no longer synchronized with where that embryo is. So, you know, therefore, if we will suggest that patients use their kit, but really not for more than a week. So if they haven't had a surge, you know, if they're going to start on day 11 or so, you know, again, the rule of thumb that I use is you take your cycle length, which in this case is, say, a 28-day cycle. Mm-hmm. You subtract 17, so that's day 11. And you start on day 11 with having sex every other day, plus you start with the ovulation prediction kit. And if you use it for 7 days, so now you're up to day 18, if you haven't had a surge by day 18, there's a problem.
There's a problem, absolutely.
Yep, so we need to move on.
I think that's exactly, I agree completely, and that we need to go ahead in the next cycle and use medications to induce ovulation or at least to fine-tune the ovulation. And I think patients that have that irregularity are really interested in fine-tuning, so I think it's easy to move them to the medication.
I agree.
And, Wendy, I want to move on a little bit, if you don't mind, because something that you wanted to talk about and something that a couple of our patients this week suggested that we talk about also, and that is uterine fibroids. This is an extraordinarily common condition.
Very,
right?
Yes.
I'm sure you see it a lot.
Oh, absolutely. I would say in general population, a third to almost a half of the women would have fibroids. And actually, a lot of times, I think we just find them by incidental finding. We may do a CT scan or an ultrasound for other causes, but then they're, oh, hey, you have a, by the way, you have a fibroid. You know, the old school of teaching that I used to train is if the fibroid is very small and they're not in the uterine cavity, and we, you know, don't worry about it, we just tell the patient, go ahead and try to get pregnant. But just recently, I think I talked with Dr. Silverberg about how important is it, you know, even with small fibroids in the uterus, even in the wall, not in the cavity, there's some impact to fertility. So that really have helped me change some of my practice. And I'd like to hear from also Dr. Silverberg, and the audience may want to know also.
Well, too, let's get Dr. Vaughn to tell us, first of all, what is a fibroid?
Yeah, Thomas, you want to define? If we back up just a little bit, I think it's real important to realize something this prevalent, this common in the population, is almost always benign. That means not cancer. In fact, the chance of malignancy is less than one half or even one-third of 1%. It's a little bit like a mole on the skin. Just because it's there doesn't mean it needs to be removed. If it acts up, then that's whenever you think about removing it. But it's a fibrous growth in the wall of the uterus that's probably genetic in basis, and it comes from a very small area, as you'd expect, small cells that grow and expand, and in the muscle wall will tend to push the muscle fibers away. And they can become quite large. And there is a little bit of, not controversy, but debate about at what size do they need to be removed? Do they all need to be removed? In general, if they're small and they're not, we don't feel like they're interfering with fertility and they're not causing symptoms, most of these women are just followed along and maybe seen maybe twice a year instead of once a year for an annual pap smear. The key to it, the real problems are when they get inside the uterus, inside the cavity of the uterus, and they usually cause more problems.
Yeah, it's, you know, we talk about a bunch of different concepts, and one of them is fibroids are like, you know, it's like real estate. It's location, 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 right? So if you've got fibroids can grow in one of three basic places in the uterus. They can grow in the cavity, and I'll talk about the cavity in just a minute, but they can grow in the cavity, they can grow in the wall, or they can grow on the outside. Most people agree that fibroids that are growing on the outside of the uterus are really not very problematic. Mm-hmm. Now, there's an exception. You know, if you've got a big fibroid on the outside of the uterus, we know that during pregnancy, those fibroids are going to continue to grow. No matter where they are, they're going to continue
Absolutely.
To grow. And so the uterus can only get so big, and the pelvis can only accommodate a certain volume before you run into trouble. And either the uterus starts to recoil and you go into labor, or you have potential problems with delivery and potentially obstruction of the outlet, or the path that the baby would take to come out of the vagina. So even fibroids that are on the outside of the uterus need to be considered in terms of pregnancy. Now, I tell my patients the uterus is kind of like a jelly donut. So the muscular walls of the uterus are like the dough in the donut, and the cavity on the inside where the baby goes is like the jelly. And a fibroid is like a rubber ball. It's a tumor, like Dr. Vaughn said, a benign tumor, but nonetheless a tumor. And so a tumor of the dough in the donut is a fibroid, whereas a tumor of the jelly on the inside, we talk about endometrial polyps or uterine polyps, which are a little bit different. But regardless, we know that these things really do need to be treated most of the time because they cause symptoms. The bigger they get, the more symptoms they cause. If fibroids push in on the cavity, they can cause irregular bleeding. If they're growing in the wall of the uterus, you think about when you have a period and that uterus contracts or cramps. If you're trying to contract around a rubber ball, it's not as easy. And so, therefore, patients tend to bleed more because they can't effectively crimp off those blood vessels as easily. And also, they get more cramping and more discomfort.
That's right. That's a lot of the patient that's come to see me and my partner is because they're heavy periods or pelvic pain. I think a rule of thumb is, I agree, if there's usually no symptoms, if that lady is not trying to get pregnant, we usually leave it alone because most likely they're benign. But if they are causing symptoms or if the lady is trying to get pregnant, and I think that's probably it's the time to consider remove those fibroids.
So how do you diagnose a fibroid?
Fibroids, well, I think gold standards is ultrasound diagnosis. Ultrasound is an imaging study that it can tell us the shape of the uterus. And is there any mass growing on there or inside the cavity? And also we can assess the ovaries and any mass growing in the lower pelvic area. So it's a very common imaging study that we pretty much order them every day, multiple times a day. And that's one way of diagnosing that.
And can patients feel them? I mean, do they ever know if they've got fibroids when they come in to see you?
Most people has fibroids, I would say, is asymptomatic. Not until they're getting a good size, usually about 5 or 6 centimeters. I think most people start feel the symptoms. Or, like you said, the location is important. If they're in the cavity, it can cause excessive bleeding or irregular bleeding. And that's usually bring the patient into the office.
Yeah, sometimes you can, even just doing a pelvic exam, feel them. But I think it's important what you're saying, Wendy, is that a lot of times the exam is normal, particularly if these are smaller ones, but in the wrong place.
Absolutely, yes.
And so the sonogram or the ultrasound study is very helpful in that situation.
Absolutely.
You know, sometimes patients can have, again, back to the location theory, they can have symptoms related to where their fibroids are. So I remember when, you know, in the old days before I did infertility, you know, if a patient would have a big fibroid on the front side of her uterus, it could really push into her bladder. And so she might leak a little bit of urine when she would sneeze or cough or laugh, or she might not be able to go very long between trips to the bathroom.
Absolutely.
You know, she'd have to go back and forth all the time. And then conversely, if the fibroid was on the backside of the uterus, a lot of women would complain of constipation.
That's right. Yeah. We definitely see those patients quite a bit in the office.
Yeah. I think anytime the uterus gets heavy and sits on the bladder, there's going to be frequency of urination. Just like a early pregnant or pregnant uterus. And that seems to be very, very common. Women are not sleeping through the night. They're having to get up to go to the bathroom. Very common. This is a very common problem with some common symptoms.
When you talk about different ways to diagnose it and you talk about ultrasound, first of all, you know, if I'm a woman out there and I don't know what a pelvic ultrasound is, I mean, is it something I should be afraid of? Is it going to hurt? Is it?
Good question. Now, pelvic ultrasound is, there are a couple of ways of doing it. One is on the outside in the lower abdomen. A lot of times you have a full bladder, and then they'll put a little probe over your lower abdomen and look inside by a sound wave. So that gave us image on the screen, and it can tell the uterus and ovaries or fibroids, is there growing in there or not. Another way of doing that is intravaginal. There's a vaginal probe. The technician usually will insert into the vagina, and that usually gives us a much more clear view of the uterine cavity, the wall of the uterus and the ovaries, and is there any associated mass growing there or not. And fairly painless, very safe to do. People worried about radiation. In this case, there's no radiation. You can do multiple times in a short period of time. There's no harm.
Yeah, I think a lot of patients will have the vaginal ultrasound, and it sounds pretty scary if you've never had one before, but it is less uncomfortable than a vaginal speculum, which is used to do a pap smear. Wouldn't you agree?
I agree.
Patients?
Absolutely.
And once the patients experience it, I think they feel like this is not really very uncomfortable at all. And the other thing I'd like to point out is the reason for the image being better is probably because the probe is closer to the uterus. Where on the abdominal wall, even though that probe may be down just above the pubic bone and the pubic hair area, it still has the sound waves have a little bit further to travel to get the image. So that's why the vaginal sonogram is so helpful.
I agree.
Well, we're coming up against another break now, and I just want to remind everybody that we're Texas Fertility Center. Again, our website, www.txfertility.com. We're happy you can spend the day before Halloween with us today, and we hope that nobody got stuck at least too long in all that traffic that was up around 183 in Mopac this morning. There was just a tragic wreck up there, and I think that's fortunately being cleared out of the way now. And we will join you on the other side of the break, and we're going to continue this discussion with Dr. Cutler about fibroids, and we're going to talk about how you treat them. Well, welcome back, everybody. We're glad you could join us after that break. And again, Dr. Kalen Silverberg, Dr. Thomas Vaughn, Dr. Wendy Cutler from the Texas Fertility Center. Wendy is joining us from the Austin Diagnostic Clinic, the OB-GYN department there. She's such a terrific friend of our practice, and we're so happy that she could join us today. Wendy, before we move back on to fibroid treatment, I did want to bring up just a couple other things. I keep talking about our website. We've got an incredible website out there. It's www.txfertility.com. It's really what's known as an authority website. It's very extensive, very in-depth. And we also are hooked up with all this social media that my kids tell me is so cool. You know, Facebook and Twitter.
Facebook.
Thank you. And I'm not sure that I really understand all the value of Facebook and Twitter, except that I can find all my high school buddies I hadn't seen in years. But anyway, so you can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. One of our staff, Jamie Leonard, who is such a terrific, very socially network plugged in person, is writing a blog for us. And she's actually on this blog doing a spectacular job of introducing our staff members. So every week she focuses on a different staff member, and you know, you can meet these people on Facebook, and it's kind of cool. But meanwhile, back to business. I'd like to talk to you a little bit and get your thoughts about treatment of fibroids. You know, you've already talked about the fact that fibroids are so common. We've covered how we diagnose them. So now what do? You've got a woman who's got fibroids. What do you do about it?
Well, usually I would say I counsel my patient based on their symptom. If the patient's asymptomatic, and I usually leave them alone. And but we will surveillance them, meaning watch their fibroid growth, probably do every 6 months ultrasounds and monitor the growth. Now, fibroid do grow because in the premenopausal women, because the hormones keep on stimulating the fibroid, it usually grows about 10-15% per year. So at some point, these women will feel some of the symptoms. So we would like to watch those. Now, if the woman has symptoms, meaning they're having pelvic pain, they're having heavy bleeding, there are options for patients. There's could be from conservative treatment to more invasive surgical treatment. Conservative treatment, we usually, if the patient has no other medical contraindication, we would like them to try low-dose birth control pills to control the bleeding and control the growth of the fibroids. Now, if they couldn't tolerate the oral contraceptives, or they couldn't, because other medical indication, they couldn't take it, then we move on to surgical treatment. And I think that at that point, it depends on this woman if she desire fertility or not. For women who desire fertility, we would, of course, preserve the uterus and ovaries, all the reproductive organs, and we would offer just a surgical procedure, remove the fibroids and repair the uterus back to a normal shape. That will help with their symptoms. But if a woman is already finishing having children, then of course we'll move on to more definitive treatment. And that could be still just remove the fibroids, or could take the whole uterus out, which known as a hysterectomy.
Yeah, you know, I think that this is a good way to look at things. There are the women who would like to be pregnant now, and they're probably not the best candidates for the medical treatment of birth control pills because they'd like to be pregnant. So if their fibroids are really causing an issue, then that would be they would be surgical candidates at that time. Then the next group are women that don't really want to be pregnant now but want to preserve their reproductive ability for the future, compared to the other group who really are not interested in having babies later or even preserving their reproductive function. And in the latter group, the more definitive treatment is to remove the uterus, which is what Dr. Cutler just mentioned. In the other group that want to preserve their reproductive function but not interested in conceiving now, sometimes there's a mixture of options of medical therapy to try to keep everything in check until they're ready to become pregnant, or if the disease is extensive, there's multiple fibroids are very large, to go ahead and remove the fibroids. And that procedure is called a myomectomy. And there's different approaches to how you remove them, which comes back to what Dr. Silverberg said about the problems sometimes are location, location, location. Well, location also determines the approach to remove a fibroid.
And Thomas, what about preoperative medical therapy? I mean, is there any other alternative? Wendy talked a little bit about putting people on birth control pills, but what else? I mean, we use other tools too, do we not?
Yeah, there's a medication called Lupron, which will shrink the fibroids, and it's beneficial for a short period of time. If you don't use it long term, because you really don't want to use it more than 6 months unless you utilize medication as what we call add back, So because without any hormones, women can develop osteoporosis or brittle bones. But this medication is very helpful for in the short term, and it's particularly helpful if you have a very large uterus that you're trying to shrink to make it easier to operate on, or if the woman has been bleeding so much that she's anemic, and now you can keep her from bleeding, let her build up her blood count, which makes her a better surgical candidate.
It really makes the operation a lot safer. And, you know, it's so true what you just talked about, because we have women who come in to see us who've got huge fibroids. And, you know, when you think about it, you think, oh, my gosh, how am I going to get these fibroids out? And the only way in the past to be able to do that was to make a very large incision. So either you would have to make an incision starting at the belly button, sometimes even above the belly button, and go all the way down to the pubic bone, or you'd have to make an incision that goes across the pelvis, you know, from, you know, one hip really to the other hip bone, to try and get a space big enough to get to the uterus. But now with Lupron, you can really give a woman a shot every month, and sometimes even every 3 months, and really get significant shrinkage. In fact, the data show that you can get the uterus itself can shrink up to 40%, and the fibroids themselves can shrink up to 60%, depending upon where they are and what type of fibroid they are. But it's so helpful.
Right. I agree. I mean, I've been using Luprons before and now also. But I do find out, you know, after you shrink these fibroids with Lupron, when you operate them, the plane is not well defined. We're talking more technical here, but the plane is when we typically like a shell out of the uterine cavity, like a squeeze a pimple almost like.
Right.
But so, you know, when you use Lupron, I've, you know, from the surgical experience that you guys all know, in the plane sometimes can be a little obscured.
So you're saying it makes the surgery a little more difficult.
Right. But I think the weighs the pros and cons, everything is not black and white in different situations. You got to analyze it differently. I definitely think Lupron has its place in fibroid treatment.
I think the concept that you brought forward is very important. And there's a couple things to think about. One is that if you only utilize the medication for 2 to 3 months, you don't have the problem with the surgical planes. The second thing is that usually you get the majority of shrinkage of the tumors within the first 2 to 3 months. So that's really important. If any of our listeners are there who are being prepared for removal of fibroids, not removal of the uterus, that they're better off just being on the medication for a couple of months. Isn't that your experience, Kaylin?
Oh, absolutely. It's so important, and everything that you said is exactly right. You know, Lupron, when it first came out, was approved for 6 months. Now the FDA has approved it for a second course of 6 months. And we use Lupron for different things. So, for example, I've had patients with bad endometriosis and pelvic pain. We keep on Lupron for years. I've had patients on Lupron for 7 or 8 years. And as long as you follow their bone density, you follow their chemistries, you follow their lipids, they're really fine and dandy, and they can continue it with add-back therapy. But for when it comes to fibroids, really, you're going to get pretty much all the shrinkage you're going to get within 90 days. You can keep patients on it for longer for convenience of surgery scheduling. You know, so a lot of our patients travel,
right,
and they'll say, you know what, or they're teachers, and they'll say, well, gosh, can I get this done over winter break? Or can I get it done over spring break? And that way I can have time to recover before I go back to work. And if you're trying to get to that specific endpoint, then, you know, you can continue it. But you're really not going to get much more benefit in terms of shrinkage.
Yeah. And I think also Dr. Vong, the good point he pointed out is to build up the blood count, because a lot of those patients are anemic.
Right. Can we talk, Thomas, would you lead us into a discussion really about surgical approaches? I mean, which of these can we take out? You know, patients will come in and they'll say, I want my fibroid to come out through my belly button, or I want it to come out through the vagina without any incisions. How do we do that?
Well, I think it's good to kind of break it into two areas. One, if it's within the cavity, the approach is through the vagina, through the cervix, into the cavity of the uterus with what's called a hysteroscope. Hystero stands for uterus. Scope is a scope that you look through the cervix, and we can remove the fibroids that way. But the other part is that if they're deep in the wall and large and extending into the abdominal cavity, then we have to get into the abdominal cavity. And that leaves us with two choices. One is a small incision with a laparoscope, lateral standing for abdomen scope, to look through an incision near the belly button, or sometimes it requires a bigger incision. But a lot of these can really be dealt with a small incision. Isn't that your experience? And if they seem to be really big, then sometimes that Lupron that we just talked about will bring them down to a size where now they're manageable through the small incision.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely, I agree. We could just get by with a 4 or 5 centimeter incision, get those
Yeah, even if you have to make
out
a big incision. And,
right,
you know, in the old days, you know,
if you needed, if a woman needed a big operation to have her fibroids removed, again, there would be these hip-to-hip incisions. And, you know, in surgery, you put in what are called retractors, and you have to move the intestine out of the way, which makes it go to sleep for a couple of days. And patients have prolonged recovery. They're maybe in the hospital 4 or 5 days, or maybe out of work 6 weeks. Well, that's all changed. So now, even with big fibroids, we can make small incisions. We don't use retractors. We don't have to move the intestine out of the way because of surgical positioning. We can take these fibroids out. Patients are in the hospital typically overnight, sometimes not even overnight. You know, I had a woman who I discharged home this morning from North Austin Medical Center, and I operated on her 2 days ago. We took out over 20 fibroids. They were huge. She had a huge uterus, and she, you know, is walking out of the hospital. She's doing great. She was walking around yesterday, and she kind of could have gone home yesterday, but she wanted to spend that extra night in the hospital. And she'll be back at work within a week.
That's right. Absolutely. I think those surgical approach really made a change of our women's daily activity and their recovery time.
Right.
Okay, so everybody's wanting to know, Kaylin, if we make this little bitty incision, how do we get these big fibroids out of a little bitty incision?
Right. It's like pulling a rabbit out of a hat, right?
There you go. Okay.
You're going to take a fibroid that's 10 centimeters, it's the size of a baby's head, and you're going to take it out of a 1 centimeter incision. How are you going to do that?
Well, let's don't leave the hour with the image of taking a rabbit out of a hat.
Tell us
how that happens.
All right, so there's a device called a morcellator, which is a long tube, and it's got a diamond tip blade now, is it not? And the blade tip rotates incredibly fast, thousands of times. And what it does is it's like coring out an apple. So you can pull a huge fibroid tumor out of a very small incision, just 15 millimeter incision or 1.5 centimeters, about a half an inch. And we can take fibroids of any size out through that incision. It's really remarkable.
So it just takes this large mass and takes it out in pieces.
Absolutely. You know, I tell my patients a meat grinder.
Well,
use that in a medical field.
We kind of prefer not to
use
that term.
Everyone hang up on this.
Thank you
for
that.
But if I explain to the patient, they understand better.
Well, it's not grinding it. We're actually just, we try and talk about fertility surgery being microsurgery.
All right.
So, you know, we are very delicately dissecting the tumor. We're not ripping it into little pieces and yanking it out.
I think we've got Snoop kind of nervous over there.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
he's not too excited about
this. Halloween weekend.
That's right.
It's kind of gruesome, but it's really not. I mean, when you take these fibroids out through this morcellator, we can take out, again, very large tumors through little bitty incisions, and it works out very well. And for those procedures, patients don't stay in the hospital at all.
Not at all.
We do these in an outpatient surgery center. Patients are in the hospital in the recovery room for about an hour, 2 hours afterwards. They go home. And typically we do surgery during the week, and they're back at work the following Monday. It's really just remarkable.
It has been just great to do all of these things through these small incisions.
Well, Wendy, I think before Thomas wraps it up here, I just want to thank you so much for joining us. It's really been so much fun. Are you still nervous or are you not nervous?
I'm not nervous at all. You guys made me feel at home.
Well, good.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, gosh, it's such a pleasure. Again, you're such a terrific friend of our practice, as are your partners. And your partners hopefully will get a chance to join us in the upcoming weeks as well. But I hope that you and your family have a great Halloween weekend.
Thank you.
Really enjoy it. And Thomas, why don't you take us home?
Yes, we just appreciate everyone listening, taking time out of this beautiful day to join us at Beyond the Birds and the Bees. Next week, Dr. Natalie Berger and Rinku Mehta are going to talk about, in general, sterilization reversal. How can women get pregnant when their tubes have been tied? And how can guys get pregnant if their tubes, that is the VAS, has been tied? And there's great hope for these people. There's great success if couples desire this. So please join us next week, Saturday at noon, on Talk Radio 1370 AM for that discussion. I'm Dr. Thomas Fong with Dr. Kaylin Silverberg and our guest, Wendy Cutler. Thank you again. We hope you enjoy the weekend, and we'll see you next week on the radio.
And go Rangers.
Yeah. How about Longhorns?
Yeah.